presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Okay, welcome everybody to, I almost said chapter. Great start. Welcome everybody to episode 23 of First Years. Today we're going to be talking about werewolves and the Marauders and lots of other stuff. And as I say at the start of every podcast that has a guest, we have a very special episode because I have my lovely friend Emily Cavender on for this episode to help us through chapters 17 through 20.
Is this where I say hi?
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Emily.
And she's very excited to talk about these four chapters.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of really important things in Harry Potter history that happened in these chapters.
Yeah, I actually have written in my notes that I think these are probably the most important chapters of the entire series.
Damn, really?
Oh, I think so.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure these are some of the most pivotal chapters. So we have a bunch to talk about. Normally we go through like maybe one or two chapters on this podcast. Today we're going over four chapters. There was no way I could split this up into like two and two. It had to be the entire section of these four chapters.
Yeah, there's not a good like pause in the middle of this.
No, literally not. So I'm going to let you decide. I have a lot to go over between Harry and Snape and Sirius and Remus. So who would you like to start with?
Okay, well, you know that I have a lot of things to say about Remus, so maybe we should wait on him.
Okay.
And talk about him later, because otherwise we'll never get to talk about anything else.
Facts. So should we start with Harry?
Yeah, might as well. He's the most boring. Let's get him out of the way.
Okay, so just to orient ourselves, so these chapters start off with Scabbers panicking. He escapes from Ron, Crookshanks dives after him, Sirius Black shows up in dog form, drags Ron under the Whomping Willow, and as he does so, breaks his leg. And we find out that there is a way to freeze the Whomping Willow in order to get into that secret passageway that we discovered when Harry got the Marauder's map that nobody's been down before. And one of the interesting things here is that we have talked on this podcast before about the Whomping Willow and willow trees and their symbolism of protection. And through these chapters, we actually learn that it's more of a protection for Lupin in this case, instead of Harry, like in book two. So in book two, we talked about it, how it was one of the obstacles that Harry has to get through in order to get to Hogwarts. And we speculated whether or not it was like a protective barrier to keep him from whatever Dobby was warning him about at school. But in this instance, we see that it is literally a barrier to keep people out of the Shrieking Shack when Lupin was a student.
Pretty effective barrier too, because it's, you know, going to beat the crap out of you if you get close.
Yeah, just a little bit. We also spoke about in that episode willows being a symbol of survival and adaptation because they can bend so far without breaking. And they're connected to the moon and feminine energy because of its closeness to water. So we have the moon symbol there that directly connects to Remus Lupin being a werewolf. So this path underneath the Whomping Willow leads them into the Shrieking Shack, and the place is a mess. The furniture is ripped to shreds. Harry says ghosts definitely didn't do any of this, which ends up being true. And thus begins our journey of learning the truth about Sirius Black, Harry's parents, and everything else. And like I said before at the top of this episode, that I think these are probably some of the most important chapters for the series. We also find out that Lupin knows the manufacturers of the map because he was one of them.
Casual.
We also learn that Scabbers is actually Peter Pettigrew. We learn about registered and unregistered animagi. And we learn a lot of really important details for this story. But one of the things, if we're going to start off with Harry, that I thought was interesting, was Harry feels this really intense wave of anger, of hate for Sirius Black, and decides that he wants to kill him. And so Harry's like, I'm going to kill this guy. And I need to point out here that Harry knows no spell that could kill anybody at this
age. Yeah, like the best thing he can do is Expelliarmus, I believe, at this age.
Yeah.
He can unlock some doors.
Literally. So, but he hesitates. So what do we think that says about Harry in this moment, that he feels the amount of anger that one would need to want to kill somebody, but ends up hesitating?
That's interesting. I feel like the right answer here is that it's that like good boy hero archetype where it's like, there has to be the anger because like, otherwise, like what's the point of the like hero's quest that he's on? But he could never actually go that far, because if he goes too far, then he crosses over to the other side and he's not like a bad guy now. But I think it's interesting that he's able to like feel that amount of hatred. And honestly, I think that's because this is the first time it's been personal. Like obviously Voldemort's the bad guy that actually murdered his parents, but he's a bad guy. So like, what do you expect from a bad guy? But Sirius was supposed to be James's best friend in the whole world. And he's finally come face to face with this guy who did something super personal by betraying his parents. So I think that like that personal aspect is why Harry was capable of feeling that much anger. But then that whole, I am the good guy, I can't, you know, cross that one final line that would make me not a good person anymore, is probably why there was that moment, very long moment of hesitation before he actually did anything.
I think that's definitely true. That's a really good point, that it is so personal. I also think in this series, we start to see, you know, at the beginning of this book, there's a big difference between books one and two and book three. Harry's really starting to grow into himself. He's really starting to stand up for himself and the Dursleys as well. And so I think this is also where it's not that Harry never felt something about the loss of his parents, but I think now that he's older, he can sort of conceptualize it in a different way. Uh-huh. And be in a way where it's not just like he's sad, but he's angry.
Yeah, he wants to do something about it. He's growing up, going through puberty. Like, he's not the little boy that he was in books one and two, who was just kind of like fumbling around. Like, he's like processing things as he's 13, almost 14 at this point. And it's not just, I'm sad because I don't have parents. It's, what can I do about it? Oh, look, this guy's right in front of me. And he did something really, really horrible to me and my family. And I want to do something about it.
Definitely. And, you know, we see with Harry from book one that he always does something about things. Like, he never really, if there's something he can do, he'll end up doing it.
Without thinking about it at all.
Exactly. So what's interesting about that, though, is that Harry talks about how his nerve had failed him because he doesn't kill Sirius Black in this moment, and that he reflects that Sirius would be given to the Dementors, and he's actively disappointed about it.
Yeah, he like thinks that he messed up by not doing something.
Right. But then Harry, at the end of this section of chapters, decides to show mercy to Peter Pettigrew, which I think is an interesting switch. And I'm going to ask you why, because it says, quote, I don't reckon my dad would have wanted them to become killers for you, unquote. So it's not necessarily about proving Sirius's innocence in this moment to show mercy. I think he decides to show mercy, and then he realizes afterward that that means Sirius gets to be free.
Yeah, which is interesting, because like, what do you know about what your dad would and wouldn't have wanted when his two closest friends are in front of you saying that they want to do something? Like, I feel like they probably have a better concept of understanding of what James would have actually wanted. But Harry has this like, my dad is perfect and amazing and a hero in his head. So he's like, my dad's great. You two must be great because you're best friends with him. And I don't want you guys to get in trouble, like, to, you know, enact this vengeance or whatever.
Do you think maybe it's because James saved Snape? And so James is the kind of person who would still save somebody's life, even if he hated them?
I mean, yeah, that's a good point. So I think it was in the first book that Dumbledore mentioned that James had saved Snape's life, but he only had just learned the context of, like, what actually happened that night. Right. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe it is the fact that he just learned that, like, given the chance, James did the right thing and saved Snape's life so that, you know, Remus wouldn't rip him to pieces that night. He knows that his dad is capable of that. So maybe that's the context that he needed to know that that's what his dad would have done in his shoes.
Yeah. It's just an interesting switch to think about, because I feel like after getting the entire story, Harry probably has more cause to be angry with Peter than he does with Sirius when he enters the Shrieking Shack.
Exactly, because Sirius just betrayed James and Lily in Harry's head, and then he learns the truth that Peter not only betrayed James and Lily, he framed Sirius and murdered like 12 people in the process, caused Sirius to go to Azkaban for 12 years, Harry to be raised by these horrible family members. Mm-hmm. Like what Peter did was like infinitely worse than what Sirius was believed to have done. So it's so interesting because like this is, it's just getting even more and more personal, but that for some reason, Harry's no longer like, I will choke you if I have to. It's like, no. Let's do the right thing. Let's turn them over to the Dementors. Mm-hmm. It's weird. I mean, Harry never makes sense to me. So honestly, I don't know that I'll ever understand his motivations here. Oh, Harry.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to what you had said about, you know, Harry's the hero, so he can't really, like, you know, murder people in cold blood. But, and maybe ultimately that's why there's a switch from, like, the author perspective. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure I fully understand the switch in this context.
It's so interesting. I literally just reread these chapters, like, in the last hour, and that didn't jump out to me as like a weird moment. Maybe it's just I've read it so many times at this point. But as soon as you asked that question, I was like, oh dang. Like why did he switch?
Speaking of Snape, he appears midway through this scene having used the invisibility cloak and definitely loses his cool, I think, in a way that we really haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think this is the first time we've seen him like fully snap, like screaming at students. That there was that line about that gleam in his eye that Harry saw, and he just knew he wasn't going to listen to reason.
Right. And what's interesting here is that Snape, in these last few books, has sort of played the role of a savior in, like, a weird way. You know, like, we see in book one where he's actively trying to, like, save Harry, but, like, none of us expects it. And he has the same, like, sort of savior moment in these scenes, but I would argue that he's probably not actually here to save the kids.
Oh, absolutely not. There's no part of him. Okay. Without opening too big of a can of worms, we could talk about Snape's motivations being good or bad, you know, until the sun goes down, because he's the most complex character, I think, in the whole series.
I would agree.
However, we do know at this point that he saved Harry over and over again. But in my head, he walks into Lupin's office. He sees the Marauder's map open on the desk. He sees the names Remus Lupin and Sirius Black side by side. And he's instantly teleported back to his fifth year of Hogwarts. And he becomes, like, as we learned in this chapter, Snape did not get along with Harry's parents or Harry's
just
dad
a little
or
bit.
Harry's friends. Like, there was no, like, good blood between them. We learned that we learned that Sirius, like, purposely tried to have Snape killed at one point in Hogwarts. So it's pretty clear here that Snape was on the receiving end of some, like, really intense bullying. So in my head, you know, as someone who did experience some pretty rough things as a kid, he sees those names on the map And he's like, this is my moment. Like, he says, I am going to be vindicated for this. Like, everyone else knows that Sirius Black is evil, but I'm going to be the hero. I'm going to be the one that gets to bring him in, where he literally says, oh, I hoped it would be me. And yes, he probably noticed that the kids were in the room and that it was dangerous because, yes, it is a full moon. But his primary motivation here is all about bringing in Sirius, and the like icing on the cake is getting to take down Remus while he's at it. Like, that's all he cares about right now.
That's so true, because he is 100% prepared to let Dementors like go after Remus as well. Mm-hmm. Now, so going along with this, do you think Snape purposefully left the Wolfsbane potion behind?
Okay, so you texted me about this a few days ago, and this was something that, and I like argued with you because I didn't remember it right. It like never occurred to me that he would bring the Wolfsbane potion with him, until you pointed out that he didn't. So I feel like it was not a purposeful choice. Yeah, I feel like it all goes back. He walks into the office and he's like, oh, what's this moving map of Hogwarts? He probably put the goblet down. He's looking at this map for the first time, seeing what it is. So there's like that shock value moment of, okay, this is probably like a major security breach, that we have a map that shows where everyone is in the castle at all times. Probably need to do something about this. And then there's the secondary moment of, oh crap, there's Sirius and Remus and Peter Pettigrew and all the kids, and they're all in this freaking shack right now. I need to get down there right now so I can like vindicate fifth year me, who was on, who like went through so much hell at the hands of these men. All I think that he was thinking about was like, I need to get down there as soon as possible, and I'm going to be the one, I'm the knight in shining armor here, and I'm going to hand him over to those Dementors, and it's going to be the best moment of my life. I don't think he was thinking about the goblet at all in that moment.
Which is why I like, it goes along with my theory of like, he's not actively trying to save the kids. Because if you mm-hmm. looked at the map and you were like, oh shit, I need to like, they need help, why wouldn't you bring the potion along?
If this was about the kids, like if he saw the map and was like, oh no, the kids are stuck in the shrieking shack with a convicted murderer and a werewolf, and it's a full moon, which I know because I brought this goblet of Wolfsbane potion specifically because I know it's a full moon. If his like one motivation here was, I gotta save these kids, he would have grabbed that goblet and he would have went down there because he knows he can't fight a werewolf. That's not a thing that people can really do when you're a human. Like,
right.
So if he really thought he had a solid chance of saving the kids, his goal would have been to get that goblet into Remus's body as soon as possible, not to run down there and get the kids and run away. Like, you can't run away from a werewolf. Like,
yeah, I mean, you could try, I guess.
But... yeah, I don't think it would go well.
So, speaking of Remus Lupin, I have a lot of, well, okay, here's my first question, you know, just to go along with the Wolfsbane potion for a second. Why is Remus not very concerned about the fact that he has not taken the Wolfsbane potion this evening?
Like, why didn't he think about it?
Well, it's not, there's no excuse for him to be like, oh, I, like, saw the map and then I fled from the room and then I went to the shrieking shack and I just forgot about it. Because Snape comes in and is like, you forgot to take your potion tonight. And Remus isn't like, oh my god, I need to leave right now.
Does Snape and Lupin talk to each other about not taking the potion? I thought they missed each other.
So, here, I'll open the book because I have it.
Yeah, I have mine too.
So, okay, it says, Snape was slightly breathless, but his face was full of suppressed triumph. You're wondering, perhaps, how I knew you were here? He said, his eyes glittering. I've just been to your office, Lupin. You forgot to take your potion tonight, so I took a goblet full along. And very lucky I did. Lucky for me, I mean, lying on your desk was a certain map. One glance at it told me all I needed to know. I saw you running along this passageway and out of sight.
Yeah, so Snape shows up and he's like, oh, Lupin, dun, 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 look who's here. I'm going to ruin your day. And you want to know how I found you? And he's doing that like class and like villain moment where he's telling the whole story of how things turned into the way they are. Yeah, no, it's really interesting that Lupin isn't like, oh, fuck, you came to bring me my potion and I didn't take it and I still
right, especially because Lupin seems like he is very responsible yes. with his condition, right?
I
he feels a
argue.
Lot of guilt around it. So the last thing he wants to do is hurt somebody.
Yeah. I would almost argue that it's probable that he has some like mild OCD about his condition and like making sure that he does things every month the way that he's supposed to.
So then why in this scene,
why did he not be like BRB and like run back to the castle to take his potion? Okay. Well, I think if he had tried to, Snape probably wouldn't have let him because he's trying to get them both arrested at this point. So he knows that before he could take his potion, he's going to have to convince Snape of what's going on. He's like trying to interrupt. They're trying to explain to Snape that like what's actually going on. And it's not going well, which is why the kids have to like literally attack their teacher. But you'd think that Lupin would have said something like, I will explain this to you and you can arrest me if you want, but if I get arrested, I'm turning into a werewolf on the spot. Like, please go get my potion. We're all going to sit right here. We'll be so good. I promise. Like, please bring me my potion. But he didn't. Man, you're pointing out some interesting things that I did not pick up on.
It's my job.
Mm-hmm. I almost want to ask my roommate now. My roommate also is obsessed with Harry Potter. I'm going to ask him that after we're done here, see what his opinion is on that.
Because it just seems like there's not even a moment where Lupin's like, oh, you know, even if he decided in that moment that it's like priorities, you know, he can't leave, you know, Sirius and the kids alone with Snape.
And yeah, and Peter Pettigrew would escape and then they can't prove his innocence.
Right, you would think at least he would have a moment of recognition of like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, like maybe once they've, you know, disarmed Snape and they've decided to take Wormtail up to the castle, he would have then said, okay, y'all go. I'm going to stay here because I'm about to turn into a werewolf in like 30 seconds. Like,
right.
Like that, I feel like that's the moment where he should have done something.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so I guess so much happens from when Snape shows up to them deciding to
that's
leave
an understatement.
the Shrieking Shack and go back up to the grounds. So maybe that was his plan. Maybe he sees Snape, he realizes that he didn't take his potion, and he's like, let's just explain. And then that doesn't go well. And like 20 other things are, so much doesn't go well. And he just loses it.
So
I don't like,
I also want to know
my favorite character.
So I also want to know though, because what's odd to me is that I'm going to open up my book again. Before these chapters start, I can find the end of chapter 16. So it says, so this is also after Professor Trelawney has her prediction. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about, you know, like tonight at midnight is when, you know, the servant of the Dark Lord is going to escape and rejoin his master. So it says, they started up the sloping lawn toward the castle. The sun was sinking fast now. The sky had turned to a clear purple-tinged gray, and to the west there was a ruby red glow. So the sun is actively setting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm curious about what time it is, because it seems like Remus doesn't turn until they are outside in the open air.
He doesn't turn until the moonlight hits his body. Like, they are on the grounds and they're walking, and it's not until the cloud moves that
right.
he turns.
So do we think that's a requirement? Like, specifically you have to be under moonlight in order to transform? Like, had they stayed in the Shrieking Shack, would he have not turned?
This is something I've thought about, like, many, many times, actually. And this is also something that I've read, like, in as an avid fan fiction reader, starting at a very young age until literally earlier today.
Do you want to define fan fiction for our audience in case they don't know?
So fan fiction, I mean, I don't know how would you define that? It's when someone decides to write within the universe of a TV show, movies, in this case, a book series, sometimes even just like celebrities in their lives. And they like to write their own additional stories. In Harry Potter, people started out by writing things because the books weren't done yet, so they would finish the series themselves. Then it turned into, oh, let's write all the missing moments we don't see. Then there's the alternate universe where it's like, I really love these characters. Like, let's see what they would look like without magic. Like, what if they were just normal?
Right.
And then some of my favorites are the non-canon compliant fan fictions, which means they read something in the books and they say, fuck that, I don't like it, I'm going to write it my way. So I'm going to say, in this scenario, maybe James and Lily never died. You know, maybe, right. They make things up that didn't happen in the series, but in their own story, it's considered fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably read fan fiction about everything you could possibly read when it comes to Harry Potter, because it's been... Ooh, I was in middle school when I read my first one, and I am 28 years old now, so it's been a while. So I've read a lot of fan fiction, and one of the things that fanfics really love to explore is what we don't know about the series. And this is one of those things, because like the Shrieking Shack windows are all boarded up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he went down to the Shrieking Shack and transformed in the Shrieking Shack his entire Hogwarts experience. So why was it that when he was a kid, he's in the Shrieking Shack and transforming, even though there's no moonlight getting in?
Mm-hmm.
But in this story, it's not until he hits the moon that, or the moonlight hits him, that he actually turns. Like, what is it about this night? Does that just happen to coincide with moonrise? Like,
right.
These are the things I think that we'll never know. And that's where fan fiction can be really fun, because it explores all of the different possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I've read stories where as long as you stay inside, you're fine. As long as you don't touch, moonlight doesn't touch your skin, then you won't turn. But then I've also read stories where it's like, no matter where you are, what you're doing, as soon as the moon's up, mm-hmm. game over.
Right.
I personally think it's probably the latter, and that this was just like a dramatic moment to make it as dramatic as possible. They all realize exactly what's going on because they all see the moon and Remus freezes, and there's this collective, oh fuck, moment.
Right, because everything that could go wrong does go wrong in these four chapters.
That was a really long tangent about fan fiction, but I got back there.
I did wonder, I was like, I wonder when she's done defining fan fiction if she'll remember what her point was.
I'm honestly shocked that I did, because I am a tangent person. I will go on tangents about anything, and then every time I finish, I'm like, wait, what were we talking about?
Well, that's why I invited you on for this specific section of chapters.
It's a good chunk.
If we backtrack a little bit in regards to Lupin, so he comes into this scene still thinking that Sirius Black is a murderer, just finding out that Peter Pettigrew is alive. And what's interesting here, and I think it speaks to, I'm going to say friendship, but I could also say relationship, because I know I know you.
We're getting there.
He comes into this room and he still calls Sirius by his first name.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that says a lot about the relationship between them. And he also realizes that they switched secret keepers without telling him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Remus has walked in.
Yes.
And he's only just realized that Peter's alive, but he doesn't quite know what it means yet.
Right.
Because he was sitting in his office and he sees the map and he sees Sirius's name and he sees Peter's name. And that's when he runs down to the Shrieking Shack to see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I texted it to you. This quote, I think, is just, like, so telling. So he, like, runs in the room. The first thing he does is say Expelliarmus. He gets all the wands in the room in his hand. And then there's this moment where everyone's frozen. And the kids are like, oh, thank God. Trusted Professor Lupin is here. And it said, then Lupin spoke in an odd voice, a voice that shook with some suppressed emotion. That's a big, important line. And then the first thing he does is he says, where is he, Sirius? So at this point, he's in the room. He sees Sirius. He doesn't see Peter. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know that Sirius wasn't the secret keeper, but he does know that Sirius didn't kill Peter.
Right.
So at this point, Remus knows that he doesn't know everything, but the first thing he does is, with suppressed emotion in his voice, say, where is he, Sirius? and like mm-hmm. uses his name.
Right.
Oh, that suppressed emotion though. When I read that, I got tingles.
It's so interesting because there's so many reveals in these chapters, not just to us, but between, you know, Harry's parents' generations, you know, mm-hmm. where they start to put the pieces together as well.
Sirius is the only one in the room that knows everything that's going on at the beginning of that scene through the end. Yes. He's the only one that doesn't learn something new. Like everybody else, it's like, whoa, whoa, oh my God. Like,
right. The only thing that Sirius learns is that Snape is teaching at Hogwarts.
Oh yeah. And he was, yeah. Cause he's like, wait, what about Snape? And then Remus yep. is like, oh, Snape teaches here too. What a dick.
So when they start to launch into the backstory, Remus says that this whole thing starts with him being bitten.
Yes.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
He says, none of this would have ever happened if I wasn't a werewolf. Like, which just goes back to his like ultimate martyr complex. Everything is my fault. The major self-hatred that he has because of the fact that he is a werewolf. Mm-hmm. Like he blames literally everything that's happened in Harry's life on the fact that he's a werewolf, which there is some stuff that I think you could blame on that, but it's a tad overdramatic.
That's not where, yeah. It's a, yes, I think, and we will talk about this when we talk about Sirius. I think the dramatic part of that is 100% true for both how Lupin handles this as well as how Sirius handles this, at least in the beginning of their exchanges. But it's interesting because we learn that, you know, that Lupin is a werewolf and that he, without Dumbledore being headmaster, he probably would not have been able to get an education.
Mm-hmm. Much less a job where he is now.
Right. And we see some like we have spoken on this podcast before about the discrimination mm-hmm. between creatures in Harry Potter. And, you know, they start referring to him as werewolf, not like the werewolf. Yeah. It's literally Ron says, get away from me, werewolf.
When I read that line again, that one really hit me because anyone who knows me in real life knows that I have no love for Ronald Weasley for a vast, vast list of reasons, which we can talk about later on in the series.
Yes.
But this was like I think this is one of the earlier moments where I was like, okay, you're not a good person. like this man that you've known for like 9-ish months now, like you've spent time with every single week, you've talked about him, he's your favorite professor, like your best friend has a very close relationship with this man. And the instant that he learned that he was a werewolf, he stopped referring to him by his name. And he said, get away from me. Like the like ingrained discrimination in that moment just like shot out at me. Like I did not remember it that way. I mean, I was much younger the last time I read the book. And yeah, reading that today, that like really rubbed me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because he's supposed to be one of the good guys. Like Ron's a Gryffindor, he's the good guy. But even Ron, raised by like great parents, light, witch, and wizard, even Ron in that moment is like, you're not a human anymore.
Yeah, I think we definitely see a lot of the biases within the wizarding world, you know, through Draco, who I think is supposed to be like the main source of like where we learn where the biases are in this world. But Ron is a huge source of that. He has tremendous privilege that he doesn't always recognize. Mm-hmm. And he also sort of has those learned biases and behaviors as a pure blood wizard in this world.
Yeah, Ron likes to think that he doesn't have any privilege because his family is poor. So he can't be one of the bad guys. He has no privilege. He's great. But then like you see these moments and you're like, hello. Check it.
So we also learn that the Wolf's Wing potion is actually a recent wizarding development, that it was not available to Lupin when he was in school, and he needs to take it the week preceding the full moon and then wait for the moon to wane again. It seems like Lupin, there's a lot, you know, it takes a lot out of him, right? You know, he sort of, he misses teaching classes and stuff like that. And I wonder, because when we're looking at like new agey stuff and talking about like manifesting with like the cycle of the moon, they always talk about like doing your rituals like the 2 days before, the 2 days after, because the energy of the full moon is still there. And I'm wondering if that also comes into play to affect him.
Okay, another fan fiction moment here. I'm going to use the word fanon here. So I talked about canon earlier, right?
Yeah, so like- canon is anything that is you can support with evidence. There's evidence in the text to support
explicitly,
it.
Explicitly, like, in the universe. Like, yes. We know it is canon that Harry has green eyes. Like, that's a fact.
Yes.
Then there are things like fanon, where they talk about things that aren't ever explicitly addressed in the series, but they're universally accepted. Universally accepted, yeah. And so one of the like really broad pieces of like fanon that I've come across in the many, many years of my Harry Potter obsession is about like the time leading up to, during, and directly after the full moon. So people will talk about they want to eat only really rare meats leading up to and just after the full moon. They'll talk about their moods being really unstable, like they're extremely quick to anger. They'll talk about their sexual appetites increasing dramatically around the full moon. It's a very like accepted thing that like leading up to the full moon, like everything seems to be kind of like an overdrive. And then after the full moon, those personality traits are still there, but they're just like extremely weak and exhausted from the like really brutal transformation their body goes through. That was something that I've always found like super interesting, is that like pretty much in any fan fiction that features Remus or another werewolf character, they'll talk about these changes that they go through, like leading up to like the week of the full moon, and how everything just kind of becomes more exacerbated, I guess is the word.
Yeah, I think that would definitely match up with that, especially with how people talk about, you know, how strong the energy of like the full moon is when it like, mm-hmm. when it comes around. So we spoke on this a little bit earlier about sort of the responsibility that Remus has for his being a werewolf and the tremendous guilt that he harbors, you know, about it. And so we find out that Remus and Sirius and Peter and James, the three, Sirius and Peter and James specifically, became animagi to help Lupin through his transformations, and that they were actually able to explore the grounds. And when Hermione points out how dangerous it is, it's clear that he feels really guilty about it. You know, he's like, yeah, like I was kind of dumbass, but I think that's a perfect example of being an adolescent and not really thinking about the consequences of your actions. You're just doing it because you're having fun with your friends.
Yeah, especially for someone like Remus, who had never had friends his entire life until he gets to Hogwarts. He meets these three other boys, and they spend all their time together. They live together. They have classes together. They're, like, attached at the hip. He talks about how he didn't want to tell them the truth about himself, but they ended up finding out anyway, and they just embraced him even more because of that. And, like, I feel like the most that you could have expected, like the positive reaction, would be that, but they took it another step further and were like, we're going to learn how to do this extremely difficult magical thing so that you don't have to be alone anymore on the full moon. And not only you're not going to be alone, but we're going to have a damn good time. I feel like sweet baby Remus, innocent little prefect, nerdy boy that he is, when he finds out his friends are doing this for him, he's probably really torn. He's like, oh my God, I have friends. They love me. They want to do this for me. But the other part of me is like, oh my God, we're going to break so many rules. This is so dangerous. Like, I could attack a student. But Remus, in that moment, all he was thinking about was probably, I have friends and they want to be with me. Let's just do it. Like, fuck it. I'm going to throw caution to the wind. I want to spend time with my friends. I want to pretend like I'm normal on the night that I'm like the least normal. Like, I want to like try to create a space where I can still have those like normal adolescent experiences where you break the rules and you sneak out and you have fun. And wasn't thinking about the fact that he's like a bloodthirsty monster. And if there was a single student outside, he would have literally murdered them. Like, that didn't occur to him.
Right. And I do have to say, we have not explored the magic of becoming an animagus, but it is incredibly difficult when you read about it. I feel safe mentioning that because they do not go over it in the books. It is extra canon material that we find out. But it is incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah, they mentioned in these chapters there had only been 7 in the last 100 years. Not for lack of trying, most likely.
Right.
Just because only people like Minerva McGonagall, who have extremely high level skills in transfiguration, are able to like master this process. So the fact that these like schoolboys were able to do it, I mean, we know that James and Sirius are talented at transfiguration, but somebody like Peter, like, that takes a lot.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure from what I remember, there's like a specific plant that you have to like keep under your tongue for like an entire month. Mm-hmm. And if you like take it out or swallow it or whatever, like you have to start all over again.
Yep.
So it's this insane. Is like, yeah, like super commitment from these guys.
And they started
guys.
Learning when they were 12, 13 years old. Like,
yes.
Not only were they like doing something insanely difficult, they were doing so at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Going along with that, though, so that sort of guilt of like, oh, you know, all of these things could have happened while I was out with my friends, carries over into wondering whether or not he should tell Dumbledore that Sirius is an Animagus. Mm. And he doesn't want to do so because Dumbledore's trust is very important to him. And he doesn't want to lose it. Did he make the correct decision? Or what should he have done in this particular situation?
Okay, I don't think I can answer this without talking about Wolfstar. And we knew this was going to happen, and I feel like it's time.
Okay. So, Emily is a big fan of a ship, which is a term to talk about relationships. So when you ship two people, you want them to be together in a relationship, whether or not they actually are canonically or not.
Or whether you know if they were ever together canonically or not.
Right.
That's an important distinction to make. Okay. So now that we've talked about shipping, there is a ship called Wolfstar. Wolf for werewolf. Remus, Star for Sirius, his name is a constellation. And some people out there want them to be together. And then there's people like me, and I will adamantly fight anybody to the death over the fact that I know that they were in a relationship. And there's lots of reasons we can get into later on in the series.
However, I need a full textual essay.
Oh God, I would love to do that. When you finish getting through all the chapters, you're going to do a bonus episode with me. That is me going through every moment of the entire series.
Yep. Yep.
Every piece of evidence back.
That would be really fun to have an entire like mini series on this podcast of people showing me textual evidence of their different ships.
I would be all over that because I have a lot of ships. But this is the only one that I believe is real. Like, there are fun ships, like Harry and Draco. I don't think that's real, but I still love it, you know? Mm-hmm. But I know in my soul that Remus and Sirius are in love. So, to me, there are two reasons why Remus did not tell Dumbledore. One is the fact that Remus's trust is so important to him. And if he admitted to Dumbledore that Sirius was an Animagus, he would not only be admitting to keeping that from him, he would be admitting to breaking every single rule that had been put in place for him to go to Hogwarts. Like, he wasn't supposed to go there, and the only reason he did is because Dumbledore The only reason why he did is because Dumbledore decided to. But there were a million stipulations in order to make everybody safe, and Remus threw literally every single one of them out when he grew up. So, yes, Remus did not want to tell Dumbledore the truth because he would be admitting that he broke all those rules as a child, which would then completely ruin this image that Dumbledore would have had of Remus in his mind. The other reason why he did not want to tell him is because he was in love with Sirius, and he did not want to betray the man that he loved. Even if he thought that Sirius was a murderer, he still loved him. Like, once you truly love someone, whether it's like a friendship or in a romantic way, I feel like you never stop. Like, there's always a part of you that's going to have that love in your heart. And so even if that person has like done the worst thing imaginable and killed all of your friends, like, he was never going to be able to let that go. And so he wasn't actively helping Sirius, but it was like the one thing that he could do that was going to maybe help him in some way, but also it was like keeping what they and their friends had like special and private still, which is the way it had always been.
So now I have a question for you based off of that. Mm-hmm. So like we mentioned earlier, we find out specifically why Snape is in James's debt.
Mm, yes.
After Sirius was going to pull a prank on him and mm-hmm. told him how to get under the Whomping Willow. Mm-hmm. With no regard to how Remus would feel.
Exactly. That was his big fuck up.
So how do you explain that? Or what do you make of that,
I guess? I could cite the 7,000 fanfics I read specifically about this point of the series. However, so we know this happens in their fifth year, right? Fifth year, sixth year, somewhere in there. Yeah. So they're 15, 16 years old. No one is a smart person when they're 15 or 16, much less boys. That is like peak stupidity of the male gender. In that moment, the only thing Sirius cared about was getting revenge on this guy that he's hated his entire life. And the like worst thing that he could think to do to him would be like, oh, I'm going to tell him about the werewolf and that could kill him. And then I don't even think about him again. Because as we see in these scenes, Sirius has a pretty big vindictive streak in him. In doing so, he was not considering the fact that his best friend, or in my head, potential boyfriend, was going to be really hurt by this. So like, let's say that Sirius's plan was right, was successful. If Sirius was successful, he would have turned his best friend into a murderer. And I genuinely don't think that Sirius was thinking about the implication this would have on Remus when he did that. And it wouldn't have been until after the fact, like the next morning, Remus would have woken up. He doesn't have any memories of what happened the night before, but his friends aren't there. And he gets into the school and he finds out that he was this close to murdering a student. Mm-hmm. And the only reason why it happened was because his best friend betrayed him. Not only betraying him and the fact that he could have hurt somebody, but like spilling his secret, like his deepest, darkest secret that nobody in the school knew about except for them and potentially Harry's mother. But he spills this like deep, dark secret of his, and doubly could have turned him into a murderer in one night. So like, to me, that is like the biggest mistake that Sirius made in his entire life. Like, that is the worst thing that he ever did. And a lot of the fanon about that is that Remus like cut their friendship off at that moment. Like, they were no longer friends for several months after that. You know, if depending on where in the school year that fell, like if that had happened at the end of the school year, like people theorize that Remus like didn't speak to him all summer. They get back to school the next year. He's still not having any kind of communication with him. And that would have been like a really big thing that they would have had to overcome together. Mm-hmm. And it would have taken a really long time for someone like Remus, who is up until this chapter, so careful about that part of himself that he doesn't share easily. I don't think he would have been able to forgive him easily.
So are we seeing a theme of betrayal among this group of friends then?
Oh my God, I think we are.
So, okay.
Long tangent.
No, I love it. This is why I was like, oh, who am I going to reach out to for these chapters? I know.
Reach out to me anytime.
All right, I'm going to cut off this episode here because Emily and I spoke for 2 hours. So next week you will get part 2 and we will continue with our discussion and do our werewolf history deep dive. One quick note before we go is that Mischief Night, which is October 30th, we are doing a happy hour at 8 p.m. on the First Years Pod Instagram page. So feel free to dress up if you'd like. Bring a cocktail. We'll be talking about a bunch of different fun Potter stuff, and you'll be eligible to win house points if you attend. So I hope to see you guys there, and we will see you guys next week for part 2. Thank you.
First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming.